The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Nobody throws me my own gun that says run. Nobody.
Took me a long, long time to learn my old bull from a hot rock. Right now I belong back in that border town, sleeping on white sheets. Go ride back to that village.
Hello, everyone. Another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Speaking of Loose Cannons podcasts, if you don't know where to find them yet, now you will. LooseCannons.net website, LooseCannons.net. You can also find our writings and videos there, along with our growing discussion on our Discus message board apparatus thing. More commenters to add to the list if I haven't mentioned them before. Nobody, Ursa Ring, I think it was 94.
Yeah.
And Peter, right?
Yeah.
Are all there, all participating. If there are any women hiding out on the message board, please speak up.
And trans, right? That's the newest one.
Yeah, did they say anything?
Didn't they?
I don't know.
I thought trans did say something, but it
was... Okay.
I can't remember exactly what it was.
Then I missed it or forgot it.
Sorry.
Today, we're going to be discussing 1960s The Magnificent Seven, directed by John Sturges, and joining us in that effort will be Michael Dwylo. You know him, you love him from previous podcasts. Say hello, Michael.
Hello.
He will be replacing Ilya today, but before we hop on that discussion, let's do a little something we like to call heralds and denouncements.
Yeah. Okay, I guess I'll go ahead and denounce something.
Sure.
I'm going to denounce the movie Tomorrowland. I watched it today. I'm very disappointed.
Todayland.
I'm very disappointed in Brad Bird. It succeeds in making the future look incredibly boring. And I didn't like any of the performances. I thought the story was really stupid. And I also thought the special effects looked bad. Like, for a movie that is so laden with special effects, it just looks bad. And that place that the main character keeps wanting to get to, the I guess, titular Tomorrowland or whatever, just does not look like a fun place to be. Like, it looks super bland. It looks like... Tomorrow Bland, yes. That's exactly what it is.
So would you rather go to that swamp or whatever that she ends up in than the titular Tomorrowland?
I would rather go to the the like post-apocalyptic world that happens after the Earth collapses or whatever, where her house is in a swamp. I'd rather go to the swamp house than that place.
Everything's
like
swamp.
That swamp part
with Hugh Laurie.
They should have called
robots.
It Swampland.
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 Be super sweet.
I did like that swamp part. I liked the way it was shot, but I also did not like that movie.
Yeah, I also didn't like the way any of the action was, I guess, shot. It.
Oh well, on that point, I would disagree with you.
Oh really?
The action was pretty good.
You thought?
Which is
I
the
know.
Only thing that made me not hate it, because otherwise
it felt...
I was pretty disgusted with it.
It felt like a theme park to me, the whole thing did.
Oh, that's fine. I don't know.
just didn't care for it. And which is bad because, I mean, you know, it's Brad Bird, and he also manages to have a female protagonist and basically a female character be kind of the strongest character in the movie, and he still just falls all over himself, especially socially. Yeah. I was just like, man.
They're really in name only. I feel like the movie's mostly about George Clooney, even though.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's like his arc or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, true.
Those two characters stay the same kind of over the course of the whole movie.
Yeah. And also the love story between George Clooney and the like little girl robot is pretty creepy.
Yeah. It's like, I was hinting at when I said some of it really.
Yeah. This is uncomfortable. He's a little too into the little girl robot. So yeah, not a good movie.
I'm with you there.
Probably gonna make my bottom 10.
Oof. Spoilers.
We'll get to talk about it again.
We're constantly spoiling our top and bottom 10s on this thing.
I just like
we have
saying
no
spoilers as an ironic joke.
I had chili for supper. Spoiler alert. Now you know what I had for supper.
And you also know that Patrick says supper instead of dinner.
Use those interchangeably. Anybody else seen any movies lately?
Normally Basil goes next.
Yeah. I will go ahead and... Harold, a movie that's on our canon. I saw Singin' in the Rain at the movie theater that I used to work at. They showed it on 35mm, and I liked it even more than the last time I saw it. The movie is really fun, really watchable, really good, super funny, all the things that we talked about, and yeah. It's a good one. I am pro Singin' in the Rain. I don't think I've ever not been pro that movie. But it was fun to watch it on the big screen with a bunch of people. Like, sometimes people would, like, clap after some of the big musical numbers, and that was kind of fun. And I liked the Broadway melody part. Like, way more than I ever have. Like, in the past, I went from not liking it to sort of liking it to liking it a bit. And now I was just like, wow, this is great. I love this Broadway melody. Some solid stuff.
Good times.
It's a good movie.
Mm-hmm. On to you.
Me?
Michael G. D.
Oh, shoot. I will herald Black Christmas, the original version from the 70s, not the remake, for sure.
Bob Clark.
Yeah.
I heard that movie's really gross and awesome.
The original? Yeah, it's there's some pretty gross stuff in it. It's really good. It's pretty tense. I usually don't find slasher movies very interesting or involving, but, you know, this one held my attention, and even though I've actually seen it before, but it's been a couple of years, and slashers, I find, aren't usually very invested in their characters a lot of the time, but this one actually seemed to care about his characters a little bit, so two thumbs up.
Cool.
Plus Canadian content.
Nice. Yes.
Support your Canadians.
Yes.
And Canada. Some interesting synchronicity. Michael heralded a movie that I don't like. I'm going to denounce a movie that I know he likes, because on the last podcast that we were on, he talked about how much he liked it. And that is Rocky.
Oh, no.
Which I saw because I thought I should see it before I see Creed, which I know I'm going to see eventually this month. And there, while there are definitely some things that I like about it, like Sylvester Stallone's performance for the most part, and there are a couple of line deliveries that I thought were really devastating, like when the guy who ends up training him shows up at Rocky's apartment to try to convince him to let him train him. He's like giving him like this weird like sales pitch about, you know, all the fights that he had where he could have done better if he'd had like a real trainer or whatever. Like after Rocky's about to like throw him out or has basically told him off, he's like, I'm 78 years old or something like that. I can't remember his age, but that's all he says. And he says it in a really like sad, defeated way that really hit me hard. There are definitely a lot of things that I really dislike about this movie. First and foremost is Apollo Creed, which is, it seems pretty clear to me that, well, I mean, everyone knows that he's supposed to be based off of Muhammad Ali, but he's definitely like the conservative white man's version of Muhammad Ali, and that he's boisterous without any sort of ability to back it up, and like kind of a fool and a blowhard. And seems like, you know, pretty much played for working class white people to like, you know, they were never able to really bring down Muhammad Ali in real life, so they had to do it cinematically. And then there's also a really uncomfortable scene with Adrian and Rocky's first date where he really forces her to like stick around, and then gets sexually amorous in a way in which she doesn't seem to be approving of up until, you know, the moment when they start kissing and then she's okay with it. Mm-hmm. And that scene made me pretty uncomfortable. So, yeah, I mean, there are other filmmaking things that I didn't love about it either, but those two things were definitely my big complaints about that movie.
John G. Avildsen is nothing but a conservative sports movie hero. That and Hoosiers. Definitely the white people's sports movies, if there ever were.
Made me think of that scene in Jungle Fever when all the Italians are complaining about how black people have taken sports away from them, and like how much they probably like this movie because it's about a broke Italian guy, you know, going head to head and almost beating the black champion.
And then in Rocky II, he does beat him. Take that, Apollo.
And then he beats another black person in Rocky III.
Yeah. I'm probably not going to watch any of the other ones.
Yeah, I wouldn't watch any of the other ones.
But I hear Creed is really good, or at least like everyone I know has liked it, so.
Who did you hear that from?
Everyone, like everyone. You're not the only one. Like Jake Cole gave it 5 stars. Matt Lynch really liked it. Everyone has liked that movie who like I know and respect their taste. Yep. So hopefully it'll be like Mad Max and I'll be the one person who doesn't like it.
No, I also
previous
I was in the middle on Mad Max.
Yeah, this
Loose Cannon's guest Mitchell Glidden, my roommate.
Yeah.
He liked Creed a lot
liked
too.
Him. Yeah.
Yeah. I've not seen it yet.
I guess in the way to transition from that to the movie we'll be discussing today, another movie about mostly white people fighting back against mostly minority people. Today's selection, The Magnificent Seven, if you want to give us a little plot description.
Yes, well, if you have seen Seven Samurai, you know basically the breakdown here. There is a Mexican village that is besieged by these, I guess you call them bandits, led
banditos.
By the banditos, led by Eli Wallach, and he comes to their town and basically wants them to give his men food just whenever they show up. And so the villagers go to consult kind of their old wise man. in the village, and he basically says you have to fight them. And so they go out at first to try to get guns, but then they end up running into Yul Brynner, and then, he says you should get men instead of guns because men are cheaper. And so basically that's what they do. They assemble a team of 7 gunmen, and they bring them to the village and go to basically defend it from the bandits. And it plays out from there, and that's, you know, it's as classic a story as there has ever been.
I didn't like this movie that much. There were certain things that I was pretty into, like certain ideas that I sort of really liked, but I felt like they didn't fully pay off. And I thought that the acting was mostly all really bad, and that there were certain moments that were like, oh, this could be like a pretty cool emotional moment, but it just felt like they were all delivered in kind of the most like theatrical, kind of like hammy 50s style acting. And so almost none of them landed for me. I was pretty into the movie for the first like 30 minutes or so, but then almost everything after that I was like in and out, and some of the action stuff I thought was all right, but for the most part I was just kind of like waiting for the movie to be over. So I guess mostly not so into it. Michael?
Me next? I feel pretty similarly to Basil. There was some stuff I liked, but overall mostly did not like the movie. The acting also was kind of a thing for me that I did not like. Some of the action scenes were filmed pretty nicely, but other than that, I didn't find a lot of stuff to really get into.
I like this movie a lot. In fact, if there wasn't the weird racial part of it that I mentioned before, and if some of the acting had landed better for me, because I have that similar complaint about certain moments in this film, I probably would have loved this film. As I sort of mentioned off podcast, I think the theme song might be like my favorite song of all time. I
actually found the score really irritating. I
overall loved the score, although I liked it. But just the theme song, like, which I had obviously heard before, even though I'd never seen this movie, but I hadn't heard it in such a specific way to know the movie that it was associated with. But as soon as it came on, I was like, oh yeah, this song. And then like the more that I listened to it, I was like, I really, really like this song, like, so much. I thought the action was really good. Like, there was a lot of stuff that was super tense, in my opinion. And I really liked the episodic structure of it. Really worked for me as well. The stuff that works the best for me is actually the stuff that's kind of the furthest away from Seven Samurai, because I did see Seven Samurai this year, rewatched it this year. And so everything that was like a scene that was in Seven Samurai, where it was like almost word for word, I was like, this doesn't work as well as it does in Seven Samurai. But everything that wasn't like as close to that, I often really, really enjoyed.
Yeah. I liked this movie, but I don't think I liked it nearly as much as Ruben. But I'll say I'm just on the side of liking this movie. I also like the music. I think a lot of this movie is elevated for me because I took a class in college called American Film and Violent Society, and we actually covered this movie somewhat, and we watched some clips from it, and my professor pointed out a lot of things about like kind of iconic Western structure that this movie is very indicative of. And as that line I was talking about earlier, the one where James Coburn says nobody throws me my gun and says run, that was one of the things he covered. He was like, this is the, you know, like, this is the mentality, like, this is the honor based mentality that these guys are operating on at this point, because they're not really in it for any kind of personal gain. And so I, you know, I kind of like it as like a, I don't know, it's about as stereotypically Western as you can be. Like, there's the bad guys and you know who's bad, and there's the good guys, you know who's good, and you know they're gonna have a gunfight, and you know they're doing it for civilization, basically.
Yeah, I definitely thought the stuff that works the least is when they kind of get away from that, like the whole class element, which is really important in Seven Samurai. Like, they try to sort of shoehorn it in at the end. It's like the farmers were the only winners or whatever, and like that makes a lot more sense in Seven Samurai. And here it just feels like, oh, it was in Seven Samurai, so it's in here as well. Like, right. This definitely feels a lot more like, let's watch Seven Gunslingers, you know, be amazing. And that's really what this movie and is a, and a should lot of be the, about.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the performances, too, I thought that there were, like, little things the actors were doing. Like, when you first meet Steve McQueen's character, when he takes the shotgun, and the guy gives him the shells, and he's just, like, taking the shells and, like, shaking them by his ear, like, it's like, when do you ever see somebody do that in a movie? But it's just, like, this little weird thing where it's like, hey, look at me. Like, I'm trying to get the audience to look at me. And a lot of it was just, like, it was these, like, actors who were sharing the screen together who were basically just, like, trying to one-up each other in weird ways. It's so funny to watch that, to, like, notice those little things that they do.
I actually really liked that moment for, I mean, somewhat similar reasons. I was like, oh, this movie's pretty cool, because, like, it totally makes sense that you would shake that and be, like, making sure, okay, there's, like, this buckshot in there, and now I'm holding the shotgun. And I was like, that's a cool little character beat. And just, like, the weirdness of them. I don't know. I mean, in some ways it feels like very 1960, like, idea of, like, racial progress is like, oh, the, like, Mexican townspeople know they can trust these guys because they're, like, not racist or whatever, because they're willing to drive a dead Native American
to that old Indian man who died.
Yeah, and that's seen, like, it's like, okay, it's, like, shot in an interesting way and exciting, but, like, if you think about it even for a second, like, logically, like, if those people are super racist, aren't they just going to dig that guy up and throw him back in the street tomorrow? Like, what has really been accomplished in this moment?
They didn't even bury him. They just left it there for somebody else to bury.
Like, well, I think it's implied that those people, like, buried him now that they had made their point or something. But yeah, I mean, that scene in a lot of ways encapsulates everything that I think, like, works and doesn't work for the movie for me personally. Like, I think the shot when they're, like, coming up on the hill and, like, the five or six people who are guarding the graveyard, like, appear over the hill is, like, a super beautiful and super tense shot. And then, like, the little, like, billowing in the windows when, and Yul Brynner doesn't even, like, look at it, and he's like, look to your left, and it's like someone in the window. Like, all of those little moments work really well, but then, yeah, like, the whole logic of the situation doesn't really make any sense. And then the big acting moment, like, which is the kid sort of, like, following them and, like, smiling or whatever, it's like, doesn't really land. Like, I guess if I were to divide the acting into, like, little acting moments and big acting moments, a lot of the little ones land, but then a lot of the big ones don't land at all. Like, Charles Bronson's speech about their fathers being braver than him and whatnot. In general, I don't think Charles Bronson should talk very much. He's a much better, like...
He's a better laconic,
movement facial actor.
Yeah. Yeah, that was definitely one of the moments that I was thinking about. And I think, like, almost all of the speechifying that goes on in the movie, which there's quite a bit of, was sort of distracting in its, like, overwroughtness. I forget who it is. There's somebody who delivers some speech that's obviously supposed to be, like, really momentous. I think it's, like, one of the townspeople, and he's, like, pausing every other word. It's like a, like, someone doing a parody of Will Shatner, where it's just like, and then we have to go, like, and that, unfortunately, that stuff didn't work for me. Even a little bit.
I was going to say the person who is the best at making speeches, I felt, in this movie was Eli Wallach, though, as the villain. I think that he delivers it with the right amount of, like, you know, he's winking, but not too much at the camera. But he just, like, looks like he's having a good time as the villain a little bit. And everybody else is so, like, stoic and stone-faced that his, like, little bit of brevity he brings to being, like, the evil guy in this movie, I enjoyed for whatever reason. It was just like, oh, he just looks like he's having fun, like, being the bad guy.
What? Yeah, I agree with that. I think that he's a fun actor in general. He's my favorite part of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as well, so maybe I should be seeking out more Eli Wallach performances. He's the best thing about two movies I don't like that much.
Two westerns you don't like that much.
That's true.
You can be even more specific and just watch Eli Wallach westerns and like him and not like the movie.
Yep. Sounds like a good use of my time.
Yeah, I thought the love story is a little clunky.
I mean, in my opinion, that part doesn't even work in Seven Samurai, and it's
that's what I was gonna say. I was like, it's not something that I remember working in Seven Samurai either. And here I was just like, this woman says almost nothing in this entire movie. Like, the only acting moment she really gets is where she's just like moving closer and closer and closer to him as he's talking. It's just like it's this kiss that's coming from like 10 feet away. He just keeps talking and she's just like
yeah, that part, the
that made me actually laugh. I was just like, just kiss her already.
The awkwardness of that interaction between the two actors kind of took me out of the moment there. Sure. It was really ineffective, I thought.
Well, in a certain sense, like, I kind of felt like the movie didn't even really want me to think of it as like really romantic. It was just kind of like two dumb kids, like, you know, being dumb and in love in the moment. So I was kind of like, I don't really care if this works or not, like, because it doesn't really matter that much to the story. And
yeah, but there's like literally no reason for her to like him. Like, there's the part where she has like this big thing about like, my father thinks you're brutes, he doesn't want me to see you, but I'm like, he is a brute, don't you remember? Like, the first time you met, he like grabbed you and threw you on his horse.
Well, I mean,
didn't he think she was a spy though?
No, he just was like, oh, you've been hiding your women, you said there weren't any.
Yeah,
I was just like, oh, he's hot. I get it. Like, super hot. I get it.
Yeah, I guess compared to everyone else in her town, he is pretty good looking. So, yeah. She's
and
real shallow.
The actor isn't. The character is obviously supposed to be either Mexican or half Mexican. I mean, his name is Chico. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they say that he's from a similar type of farm town.
Yeah, he was supposed to, and there was the part where he was like passing as a Mexican bandit when he infiltrated their camp.
Yeah.
I mean, that's technically true of Eli Wallach as well.
Yeah.
He's also passing as a Mexican bandit.
Eli Wallach.
Again,
is...
I feel like I would have liked this movie a lot if it was just about a poor town of white farmers. Like, they're not ready to include this stuff in 1960, apparently. I mean,
yeah, especially
kudos
when
to them,
like, trying to show that the people are like really in touch with their sort of like native
I forgot about
Los Indios roots, where they're doing the like big dance and everything. I was very uncomfortable during that moment.
Yeah, any time that stuff comes up in movies, like I watched the 1970s version of King Kong recently, and there was the same thing. It was like the natives dancing. It's like, oh no, this is no. There's no way that this is going to be sensitive in any way.
It seemed like a very sort of, they were trying very hard to be not judgmental, but it just ended up seeming very awkward
And, yeah, for a pre-civil rights movie, I guess, like, it's in some ways surprising that they're trying to handle this at all, but, I mean, you know you're going to fail when you're going to try to be sensitive to racism and then not cast Mexicans.
Yeah.
I mean, you've failed before the movie has even started.
Were any of the Mexican townspeople played by Mexican actors? I meant to look that up.
I didn't look it up. That would be a good thing to know, I suppose.
I saw the cast list, and some of them had Spanish names, but I wasn't sure if they were Mexican.
I'm sure some of them did. They had at least one.
There's a Anthony Mann, like, sort of noir mystery movie that's all about, like, kind of border tension and border conflict, that's, like, I think was made like 10 years before this, in like 1950, and other than like one kind of awkward scene, it does a pretty good job of like being not that patronizing about, like, it feels like less patronizing almost than a movie made today probably would be. I guess Sicario did better than I expected it to, but I don't know.
I'm like something like... not going to go out on a limb and say Anthony Mann is much smarter than John Sturges.
Yeah. Well, I felt bad for John Sturges a little bit because Amazon, where I rented this movie from, has the director listed as Robert Aldrich.
John Sturges.
Poor Sturges.
I'm assuming this is his biggest movie.
Didn't
tell you any other John Sturges movies.
This has no meaning to Basil, apparently, but when I was watching this movie, one of the first things that I thought was maybe I should give Bad Day at Black Rock a second chance, because the main thing that I didn't like about that movie was the score. And I thought the score was decent to great in this movie, so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think I would have maybe liked it more if it was used more judiciously, but I feel like it's, like, constantly playing. Like, there's almost no, like, scenes except for, like, the speechifying ones that don't, like, have the score just, like, playing throughout. And because it's so noticeable, I was just distracted by it a lot. And I might have liked this, I meant to say this when I was first talking about it, but I might have liked this movie more if I hadn't just seen The Wild Bunch like less than a month ago, because that movie's only like 9 years after that this one, and it feels like such a, I don't know, the same movie but really sad about like a bunch of dudes who like you know, make their living shooting people for as opposed to this, that like the guys seem sad, but like the movie is still like these guys are pretty cool.
The score, if anything, is still, like, I think, thundering and be like dun, 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 dun.
If anything, like sort of what I was saying before, I think the problem with this movie is that it tries to do any of that instead of just accept that it is the 60s equivalent of a straight up action movie and just go full bore speed on you and like cut the themes out completely and just be like, you know, an hour and 40 minutes of shooting.
Yeah.
And tension.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
I was going to make a joke and say Walter Hill's version of Yojimbo. It's a really bad movie.
Yeah, there's almost no gunfighting in that movie. There's like an orgy of fighting at the end that I didn't really like. But there's like a lot of like talking and walking back and forth places, which is true of the original movie Yojimbo. But that movie is shot by Akira Kurosawa and heralded by Toshirô Mifune. So...
Yep.
They can
make someone walking from one building to another like extremely tense in a way that Walter Hill and Bruce Willis couldn't handle.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
It's too bad. That seems like almost right up Walter Hill's alley, but it's a really bad movie.
It sure
and
is.
I was very sad to discover that. I was like, Walter Hill, he's sort of like a perfect guy to like redo.
I feel like... I mean, I guess I need to watch some more of his. later stuff, but I feel like Walter Hill, more than maybe any other director that I've seen, like, at a certain point just lost it and then just couldn't make anything good whatsoever anymore. Like, he had this nice, like, long, like, this nice string of, like, really strong movies, in my opinion, that are, like, really weird and upsetting and violent. Kind of like the opposite of your, like, Wild Bunch. It's like the people are as gross, but it's not clear that the filmmaker is really judging them for, like, how right. uncomfortable and gross they are. But, yeah. But then, like, Last Man Standing and more recently A Bullet to the Head are not good.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like John Carpenter could give him a run for his money. Ghost of Mars is really terrible.
Something about those late 70s, early 80s American directors just couldn't really sustain.
Did not sustain
that quality once the weirdness of the 80s ended.
Oh, man.
The Ward is also bad, and he made, like, no movies in between those two and has no interest in making movies anymore.
Yeah, just go back to playing video games and making music, John Carpenter.
Yeah,
that album pretty cool.
I didn't realize that John Sturges also directed The Great Escape.
He sure did.
Also, like a gathering together of, you know, tough dudes movie.
Again, another movie that I would enjoy a lot more if they just put it in an entirely different context. Like, if it was just about a couple of American prisoners, maybe, like, ones who hadn't done the most serious of crimes or something like that. Like, doing, like, a prison escape, like, that might be fun. But, like, again, that movie, like, tries to be really serious at certain points when it's mostly just, like, a fun prison escape movie. And it basically makes, like, a lot of the other stuff, like, not land for me. I don't know if we want to talk about the ending of The Great Escape, but it really bothers me a lot.
I never seen it, and I probably never will, because every time I've seen that, that's like 3 hours long, I'm like, that's too long for what this movie is. Way too long.
I think I watched it for a class in high school, as impossible as that is to imagine. I mean, I know I watched it, and I'm pretty sure I watched it for a class, and I definitely didn't watch it for a class in college, so if I did watch it for a class, it was in high school, which means we watched it over, like, 5 periods.
Yeah. Apparently there is also a Magnificent Seven remake.
There is.
On the way.
Coming out next year.
Yeah. How, like, topical. If you look at the cast, you're like, this is maybe promising. But then you look at the director and you're like, never mind.
You're like, oh no, not Antoine Fuqua. No. No.
Speaking of movies that could maybe be fun if they just accepted their premises as opposed to trying to reach at something deep or gritty or significant, Antoine Fuqua's entire career.
Oh, boy. Oh, my God.
Ugh. Also, speaking of racism, but more overt intentional racism in the world of Antoine Fuqua than the world of John Sturges.
Gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. I have some things to say about Antoine Fuqua at the end of the year. But I will not reveal which list.
You already have. You announced it earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Some smaller acting moments that really did work for me. For instance, I laughed pretty hard at the line when Charles Bronson is out back chopping the wood and they say that he's broke and he's like, no, I'm just an eccentric billionaire. I always am a little surprised at Charles Bronson's comedic abilities.
He's got a very good deadpan.
I even like when they say, like, how much they're gonna pay him or something like that, and then he's just, like, standing there with the axe with, like, the giant piece of wood, like, stuck to it.
Yeah.
He's just, like, staring at them. I thought that was funny too.
Yeah, I was wondering, what is he doing? Like, he gets the axe, like, stuck in the wood, and then he picks the whole thing up and, like, tries to break it that way, and then he, like, flips the axe over and hits it the other way, and I was like, is that really how you would do that? Because I feel like he's not doing a good job chopping that wood.
I feel like he would probably know better than you. But,
yeah. For some reason, I trust that Charles Bronson knows how to chop wood.
Maybe.
It would be funny if he actually knew how to do it, but the director just told him to do it that way anyway. It was the wrong way.
Just do it wrong.
Look better.
Just look like you don't know what you're doing.
I mean, getting the axe stuck in the wood is a real thing. I've seen my dad chop wood a lot, and he does that sometimes, or did that. I don't know the last time he chopped wood, or if he ever will again. But when I was a kid, he did.
Whenever I think of chopping wood in movies, I always think of the scene of William Shatner as Jim Kirk in Star Trek Generations when he goes to visit him in, like, the perfect alternate dimension. And apparently, like, that's Jim Kirk's, like, perfect world is just being in a log cabin, like, chopping wood all day.
Oh, man.
Settling down with a lady who loves him. Mm-hmm. None of this space shit.
Oh, I didn't even remember the love part. For some reason, what stuck with me was, like, this guy's perfect world is just chopping wood all the day.
Chopping wood and laying wood.
Good on you, my man.
And sometimes chucking wood with a woodchuck.
I think Yul Brynner is really hot. I don't know what to say about his acting. Well,
that is, I mean, I think a lot of the actors here are just like...
But I kept looking at it. Well, it's like, you know, Steve McQueen is such like a... I feel like such a renowned sex symbol or whatever that I guess I would expect to feel like he's the hottest one in the movie. But when, like, he's riding with Yul Brynner, I'm like, I am way more into whatever Yul Brynner is doing than Steve McQueen.
His costuming helps a lot too. That black shirt is like really cool looking, and it fits him super good.
Yeah, they said that this was something that my teacher brought up when we were talking about this movie. He said that Yul Brynner had this trick that he would do with other actors whenever they would try to one up him on screen. Is he would tell them that if they don't cut it out, he's going to take his hat off. Because when he takes his hat off, nobody can not look at his bald head. So he would just take his hat off, and then everybody would be looking at him. I thought that was a really funny gamesmanship.
It seemed kind of interesting that Yul Brynner's character was like supposed to be the good guy, and yet he was the one who was clothed all in black. Because up until that, like this time, like usually the bad guy in these sort of hokey Western movies would be like all in black, and then the good guy, you know, be wearing the white Stetson or whatever. But I don't know if that was intentional or.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be at that point. Like, it's such a motif that there's no way you could like do it on accident. Be like, this looks good in a black shirt.
Well, yeah, I think it's what Ruben was talking about earlier. Like, it's kind of trying to call back to like the, oh, maybe it's not, you know, maybe these guys aren't the good guys, and maybe there's some sort of like commentary here, but. Again, it doesn't really follow through with it enough to like really say or anything interesting about it.
Maybe the idea of like a funeral or whatever, that this is like the end for the gunmen or whatever. Because I mean, that's part of the thing that I think was interesting that they could have explored, but then they kind of just let it drop, which is like Eli Wallach when he first shows up. It sounds like he used to be a person sort of like the guys that they end up hiring, that like he used to be like a gun for hire, but now like the West has been quote unquote civilized or whatever, and so there's no jobs for these guys, so they're like, well, we don't know how to do anything else except for kill people, so we might as well just like kill people and steal stuff since no one will pay us to kill people anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the things where I feel like it's an interesting twist on how it is in Seven Samurai, because Seven Samurai, it's all about how the feudal culture is dying, and so therefore they have no more lords, you know, who control them, and so they're just sort of these wandering Ronin, like, looking to do anything. And, like, in that case, like, it's like the system left them behind, but in this case, like, cowboys were, in a sense, never particularly good to begin with.
Right.
And what's happened is the world is becoming better, and right. Now they're they're still stuck in, like, this position of, well, we can only do this one bad thing. But, yeah, I mean, I guess if you were going to take any of the themes that are sort of explored in this movie and make this more than just straight up an hour and 40 minutes of action, then, yeah, that would be the one to go for. I thought there was a...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I thought that there was kind of a... They did a nice way before when Steve McQueen and Yul Brynner are talking about it earlier in the film, like, where they came from, and, like... they're, like, complaining about the fact that they don't have anyone left to murder, in a way. Right.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that, again, to, like, draw the comparison back to the Wild Bunch, that I think that the Wild Bunch does really well, is that, like, I mean, it's somewhat obvious in the fact that, what's-his-name's character, shit, I can't remember, used to be in, William Holden's gang, and now he's helping the other people hunt him, but that basically they're both two sides of the exact same thing, like people who don't know how to do anything except for murder other people, and that they have like zero place in the world anymore.
Yeah, I mean, all my favorite westerns get to the grossness of it on some level,
right.
And so this was never going to be one of my favorite westerns, but I don't feel like I can enjoy a Western that's just, you know, nostalgia.
Oh, sure.
Something that never existed.
Well, with, just to go back to the idea of the civilizing of the West and how it was kind of an improvement, though, at the beginning, they kind of, when that businessman, I guess, is trying to have the Native American guy buried. Mm-hmm. He's talking about how before they sort of civilized the area, nobody would have had a problem with him being buried in that cemetery. But now that all the quote-unquote civilized people have moved in, you know, it's not, it's more of a problem now. I don't know. That was
right.
Sort of, an intentional commentary. You know, it's like in Seven Samurai when they talk about, you know, the problems of civilization don't necessarily, it's not necessarily a steady progress in one direction, even though, you know, there's good and bad that comes with it.
Sure. And I think that's...
It used to be so egalitarian. Somebody would just murder another person, didn't matter what color they were. It's fine.
And again, to go back to Anthony Mann, I feel like Man of the West is sort of a perfect film for about the things that are sad about, like, encroaching civilization, and the fact that, like, in that movie, it's Gregory Peck, right? Who's the lead? Yeah.
Like, yeah, in Man of the West.
Yeah, he wants to be civilized, but, like, simply because of, like, when he was born and, like, what he had to do during that era, it's like he can never escape it. Like, he can never be part of this civilization that he wants to become a better person. But he's, like, constantly dragged back down into this world of terror and murder.
Yep. Anthony Mann's a cool guy.
Yeah.
And I guess it's sort of the same way with the bandits, too. They're not really able to make the transition into the new sort of civilized era that they're supposed to. So they have to resort to banditry to survive, you know. I imagine that they were probably not always, they weren't born into it, they probably had to come into it in some way or another, and it probably had something to do with them not being able to make a living in any other way.
There's still space in the late 1800s and early 1900s for farmers. There's not a space for people riding around shooting people.
Yep. Yeah, and I thought that that was one of the more interesting things. Like, I mean, we've talked about it before, but that, you know, that Eli Wallach as a bandit, he's not, like, emphasizing, like, you know, we need this money so that we can, like, I don't know, like, gamble or whatever the things that villains usually do in Western movies. He's like, I've got 40 men that rely on me. They need food. They got to eat. Like, what am I going to do? My only choice is, like, steal the food from you.
Like, kind of the whole crux of the movie is, like, the original plan is, like, just to make it harder to get the food and hope that he'll move on. Mm-hmm. But then that doesn't happen, not because it's not the right idea, but because they're starving. Like, they can't move on.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Mm-hmm.
And
if only they played it a little sadder instead of being really excited to kill all those starving Latino men.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Do what?
The part that was pretty sad, too, was when they were trying to count up how many... The bandits were trying to count up how many of them had died, and they couldn't even keep track of how many of their friends, I guess, had been killed. And then Chico walks up, and he's like, oh, yeah, you forgot that guy, too. He probably killed him. Really?
Yeah. Yep.
Disturbing. But it's kind of played for laughs.
Eerie. It is.
It's like, don't forget this guy.
You didn't remember that.
Got him pretty good. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they got him pretty good. Not me.
Yeah, it's something that I don't, but even, I guess, not as perfectly delivered as it could be here. I feel like it's not delivered really at all in Seven Samurai, so I actually feel like that's an improvement from that movie to this movie.
Yeah, the bandits are more kind of like a force of nature in Seven Samurai. Yeah. Like, you don't get to know them hardly at all in that one. Although I do like the way that they the way that the villagers know that the bandits are coming in Seven Samurai more than here, where it's just like they just ride up and they're just like, yeah, we're going to come back and kill you later. Like in the other one, it's like the bandits are riding through the field and they're like, ah, we'll come back when they have more food. And then it's like the two guys who are just like terrified just like emerge from behind the thing and they're like, ah!
Yeah.
Although I did sort of like the structure of this, like where Eli Wallach shows up for like the second time, like the real time, only like an hour into the movie, and I was like, how is there still an hour of this movie left? Like, this is like the climactic part of the movie, right? And then they just managed to figure out a way for them to shoot at each other for the next hour.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's what we mentioned before. Something that I think is kind of cool is that they're like, oh, okay, the plan was, well, shoot at them and they'll go away, but then it's like, oh, they're starving, they can't go away, like, I, and then it makes the whole last 30 minutes like kind of different in a way. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I would have probably liked it more, except for I actually didn't like the final action scene very much. I thought it was like sort of, the geography of it was confusingly laid out, where it like cut to Charles Bronson on a roof, or like cut to James Coburn like hiding behind a hay bale or something, and I was like, I have no idea where Charles Bronson is in relation to James Coburn. Like, they're all shooting at people, but I don't know, like, why is like for one thing, why is Charles Bronson not able to just like murder everyone because he's like up on a roof, which is like an extremely advantageous place to be. But and then there were
Charles,
like,
Bronson.
It's true. And there were also like several shots where like the camera would be following a character and they would like run inside and there's like a bunch of gunshot sounds and then they run out and I'm like, I don't know what just happened, didn't that? Like, I guess they shot some people and survived.
That was usually Chico, I think, who would do that, and I think that was sort of intentional. Chico, that he was supposed to be like an idiot savant gunslinger.
Yeah. That would never compare to the scene when Toshirô Mifune like finally faces off against like everybody. He's like going crazy and like falling over in the mud. That seems pretty iconic.
To elaborate on Basil's point, I would have liked it if they'd kind of made a little bit more use of the village. Like, it looked like a pretty big place with like a fairly large set, and they didn't really like I thought somebody was going to be posted up in the bell tower or something shooting at people. That didn't happen. You know, there looked like a lot of buildings and stuff that they could have made use of, but it didn't really, you didn't really get a sense of the village as a place with real, you know, with real buildings and things that they can interact with. It was just kind of very staged feeling, if that makes sense. Like, everybody was in a specific place, not for a reason, but just because that's what suited the story, so that everybody could be shot.
Separate from each.
Yeah.
I also thought that the tactic that Eli Wallach and the bandits use of just like jumping on the ground is really bad. Like, I was like, why would you not stay behind cover? Why would you just jump out in the middle of the ground like that? Like, it just looked, it's like, that's not a good plan, guys. You're gonna get shot by the guy that's on the roof. He's got like, you know, all kinds of a bead on you. I think it was kind of funny whenever like they let the farmers out of the prison, and they just come out and just start like beating on guys. The one shot that made me laugh really hard was where the guy's running and the woman like hits him over the head with the thing and he just like goes flying. I thought that was really funny.
I definitely think that the best action sequence is the first encounter with them. I thought there was a really, really awesome part where Eli Wallach and another guy are, like, trying to ride out of town, and they're, like, jumping over these, like, created walls, and they're, like, keeping up, like, it's a tracking shot that's, like, following them, bouncing up and down, like, from left to right, and I thought that shot was really dynamic and awesome.
Yeah, and I like that. I like how quickly that scene, like, becomes an action scene that you're kind of not expecting, because they're all just like standing out in the open, like talking to each other. And I'm like, man, if like Yul Brynner and stuff starts shooting right now, that's like kind of a really bad idea, because he doesn't have any cover. But then they just do it anyway, and it's pretty intense. I agree that that was my favorite action scene as well, and also sort of just like how brutal it is, where they're like really trying hard to chase them down and like keep any of the bandits from escaping, which is a pretty, I don't know, I mean, it makes sense in war, I guess, but it's a really dehumanized way to like look at strategy. Like, it's not good if any of these people escape, so we're gonna try and murder them all. Like, Steve McQueen gets on a horse also and, like, tries to chase after him. I don't know. Yeah.
Yep.
But they were right. It's a bad idea to let him escape. Then, like, all seven guys were fine, but by the end...
they were not.
Four of the seven are dead.
Different ones, though, if we're doing this, because three of them live in a Seven Samurai, but Toshirô Mifune is not one of them, and that kid is clearly supposed to be the Toshirô Mifune.
Is he? Yeah. I thought he was supposed to be the young guy.
But then who's Toshirô Mifune supposed to be? They kind of collapsed this too.
I don't know.
I thought it was Charles Bronson was the.
But he.
Mifune. No, he's way too.
I don't think it's skilled. I don't think it's a one to one thing. Honestly, like.
A lot of them are one to one, though. Yul Brynner is clearly Takashi Shimura, and then like, you know, he's still got his friend. They even play the same joke, where like he's standing behind the door, and then the guy doesn't come in. And he's like, "What kind of fool do you think I am?" It's not one to one. I feel like they took some characteristics of. I mean, he's definitely the Toshirô Mifune character when he delivers the speech about being one of the farmers, because that's
yeah
that's Toshirô Mifune's character.
But he's also supposed to be the kid, because the kid's the one that has the, you know, the love story, as it were.
They collapsed those two.
Just made him one character. Just made him one guy.
Threw in another expert instead of having two non-experts.
I don't have anything else to say about this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of wish they had left, like, backstory elements out. The guy who has nightmares and is, like, afraid to fight, and then he, like, finally does fight, and then he gets killed. I was like, that's not a good arc for this guy. But
one fly. I used to be able to catch three. Yeah, no, that's after the Charles Bronson speech, that probably his nightmare or whatever is the second biggest acting complaint I have.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what's supposed to be a big moment not landing. Although I really like the first scene that he's in, and like how creepy it is when they like call him to his hotel room. And I like a lot of that scene.
Yeah, it was shot in a really interesting way where it's just like this completely, he's just like sitting in the dark, and they just open the door, and the door is the only light in the room.
And it's like fancy dress too, compared to like the rest of them. Yeah. And like his unnerving stillness, I don't know. I liked a lot of that scene, a lot.
Yeah. And I like the admission at the end, like when they have to give him the $20 up front because they're extorting him, because they know he's wanted, so they're charging him $10 a day to sleep in that shitty room with no windows.
Yeah. I like the scene with the clapping. I thought that was cool. Where he claps hands around the kid's gun.
Yeah.
And
he tries to get the kid to clap, and he won't do it because he knows he's going to fail.
Yeah.
I mean, he won't pull his gun because he knows he's going to fail.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess drunk acting is very hard, but the kid is not very good when he comes back.
No.
Should have watched Jimmy Stewart in Philadelphia Story. Some really fun drunk acting.
Michael?
I don't really have much else to say about the movie, to be honest.
Okay. Wrap it up. Seems good. Wrap it up. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to our discussion of The Magnificent Seven. If you're enjoying discussions like these and more, subscribe to us using your podcast listening application. Give us a 5-star review on iTunes so that more people can enjoy us, and continue to listen and enjoy.
Do it. Don't give up on us.
I mean, if you're already enjoying, I don't know what you would be giving up on. Don't give up on enjoying us. Continuing to enjoy us. But I guess for now, we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.